Susie, thank you so much for joining this call. We've been made a practice since we started Sapir over a year ago to have conversations with some of our authors. I wish we could have them with more of them. You wrote an essay on the Amnesty International report that anyone who's on this call is, I'm sure, reasonably familiar with. For the fifth issue of Sapir, which you have, I think, in front of you and I have, it is a real paper issue, as you can see here, beautifully designed. The fifth issue is on Zionism. It follows the first four, which were around the themes of social justice, power, continuity, and aspiration. As we speak, we are working on our sixth issue, which is on the subject of education. We decided early on when we started Sapir that every issue would be devoted to a particular theme. Sapir is subtitled A Journal of Jewish Conversations, but we're thinking of changing the subtitle to more accurately reflect what it is that we are trying to do, which is that we are a journal of ideas for a thriving Jewish future. There are a few ways in which we are maybe distinct or distinguished from other Jewish publications. We try to include authors from across the political spectrum, left to right, and we try to include authors from across the religious spectrum, from the Orthodox and very observant to secular authors, Israelis, Americans, and others. The final thing which I think distinguishes Sapir is that we ask many of our writers to be prescriptive, not just diagnostic. It's one thing to figure out what the problem is. It's a harder thing to offer ideas about how we can move forward intelligently and hopefully with some clarity and even some unity. So that's what we've been trying to do with Sapir. And having you join us, Susie, is really a wonderful honor. I first came across your name, I should say, because my colleague, Felicia Herman, when she first visited me at home, she very, very proudly gave me as a gift The Lion's Den, Zionism and the Left from Hannah Arendt to Noam Chomsky, which is your book from, I think, 2019. Is that right? It's a wonderful book, a learned book, and an important book. And in some ways, the basis for the article that you have written for us, which is the latest installment of the Left's long-running acrimonious divorce from Zionism and the idea of a Jewish state. So let me actually begin with this book, Susie. You trace a long history. Zionism initially began as a project of the left, primarily speaking, not exclusively speaking, but of the left. How did the relationship become, I know this is a large question, how did the relationship start to become so unsettled? When did the romance start to sour?
So that's a complicated and long question. I would say that, of course, there were always leftist critiques of Zionism. Marxists often tended to be very critical of Zionism because they were critical of all nationalisms. They were anti-nationalist, and Zionism is, of course, the nationalism of the Jewish people. But that actually also, for some Marxists, changes with the Holocaust. So you have people like Isaac Deutscher, Max Horkheimer, after the Holocaust saying, "Oh my God, we were wrong to tell people not to go to Palestine." And someone like Deutscher, although he was never a Zionist, He goes to Israel many times. He has relatives there. He's very interested in the kibbutzim, et cetera, et cetera. Even someone like Hannah Arendt, who was sometimes a Zionist and sometimes an anti-Zionist, she was very anti-national, but even she was very, very supportive of Israel in the 67 war, in the 73 war. She said, you know, the destruction of Israel would be the greatest catastrophe for the Jewish people. So when people say, was Marxism, you know, anti-Zionist, those thinkers had a much, much more complicated relationship, I think, to Zionism and then to the actual state of Israel. One of the things I think that's happened on the left today, although maybe this is true of the left in terms of many issues, is a kind of horrible reductionism, where you are, quote, pro-Israel or anti-Israel. Mm-hmm. And when people ask me that question, you know, I sometimes say, well, you know, am I pro-France or anti-France? Am I pro-Senegal or anti-Senegal? You know, what does it mean to be pro or against an actual nation? But the relationship, I would say, was always complicated. But many, of course, of the early Zionists, they come from Russia, they come after the 1905 revolution or after subsequent events, and they are very much socialists, if not necessarily Marxists. I think that it's generally said that it's the 67 war and the beginning of the occupation that really changes that. But one of the things that I argue in my book is that there's a sort of perfect storm in 67 and 68. And what you see in 67 and 68 is really the international left turning away from the Western proletariat, which was traditionally the source, was going to be the source of socialist revolution. And it's clear that the Western proletariat is not revolutionary. And you have really the turn to the third world of the left, Algeria, Vietnam, China, Cuba, that the third world is now seen as the great revolutionary force. And I think it's the combination of that along with the 67 war and the beginning of the occupation that really turns so many leftists against Israel. The Palestinians,
go ahead.
I'm just gonna say the Palestinians are seen as the third world peasantry. Israelis are seen as the first world, although they're not first world, white, although they're not white, colonialists. And so that paradigm, which was happening in the left, in the Western left all over the world, is sort of imposed on Israel. Although still at that time, Israel itself had a very, very strong labor and left of labor movement. Zionist movement.
Just briefly, to those who are in our audience, in about half an hour or so, we will start. I will start asking your questions. But now is a good time, as Susie speaks and questions occur to you, to populate the chat function or the Q&A function at the bottom of the Zoom window with whatever questions you have as they occur to you, and I will try to get to as many as I can. A related question, Susie, to what extent is opposition, the left's opposition to Israel, just simply the sibling political tendency to anti-Americanism? I mean, Israel becomes a client state of the United States, or at least an allied partner of the United States, really after 1967. And to some, you know, the formula of the great Satan and the little Satan sort of neatly expresses a kind of a view that support for Israel is support for America, and opposition to Israel is kind of opposition to America, that it's really a function of a broader politics rather than of what Israel does or doesn't do or is or isn't.
Yeah, Dan Diener, the German Israeli theorist, who has written about this, I think, in cogent ways. That is partially true. My students sometimes say, you know, Israel was created by the U.S. And I was like, no, actually not. The U.S. actually wasn't particularly supportive of Israel until after 67. And of course, the Soviet Union is arming the Arab states. So the whole Middle East becomes part of the Cold War, not so Cold War. I think that that is true, that there is some of that. But I also think that even were, let's say the US was going to withdraw all its support from Israel, no sales of military equipment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My own sense, at least from being in academia at a fairly left-wing university, is that that would actually not, at this point, I feel that the animus towards Israel, at least on parts of the left, is so extreme that I'm not actually sure if that would change. But on the other hand, you know, even the left's relationship, I think the American left's relationship to our own, the question of US imperialism is also changing with Ukraine. Because a lot of leftists, of course, are very, not all, but there are a lot of people on the left who I know, I read, who are actually very supportive of the US aiding Ukraine. And there's a sort of, I think, a little bit of a reevaluation of the left of like, wait a second, imperialism isn't just the US, there's Russian imperialism, there's Iranian imperialism, et cetera, et cetera. So the relationship of the left to the US, I think, is changing a little, which may change some of the relationship to Israel. But I actually think that although it's probably true that originally in that 67, 68 period, and remember, again, that's the middle of the Vietnam War, that Israel is very much linked to the US in the left's eyes. At this point, I think the animus has really taken on much more a life of its own. Even if you know, the US became a social democratic state with Bernie Sanders as president, I'm not sure if the left's animus towards Israel would change that much.
So this is an interesting point because, you know, one of the left's objections to Israel is, at least in theory, an objection to the very idea of the nation state, right? And this is, you pointed this out just a few minutes ago, Marxism doesn't look, at least in theory, with much sympathy to the concept of the nation state, although that changes, waxes and wanes over time. But certainly you look at someone like Tony Jute or Jutt and his notorious essay from back in 2003. And the argument against Israel is an argument against the nation state. And this is a theme that actually you raise in your essay in Sapir. Suddenly the idea of the nation state doesn't seem to look so bad. The idea of sovereignties clearly has a set of virtues, but your argument is that the animus goes deeper, and that raises my question, which is the extent to which there is, if there is, but the extent to which there is a kind of infiltration of an anti-Semitic spirit in the left's current critique of Israel. And I wanted you to take on that question of the degree to which the virulent anti-Zionism, I'm not just talking about criticism of Israel because you offer plenty of criticism of your own, but the virulent anti-Zionism is in fact not just a cousin of, but maybe a cover for a kind of left anti-Semitism.
So let me just backtrack. That's an interesting question to get to this question of the nation state. So there were thinkers who were genuinely opposed to the nation state. Hannah Arendt was one. Isaac Deutscher was another. They were genuinely opposed to the nation state. What you have again in that 67, 68 period on the left is something very odd, because the movements that the left was championing were profoundly, profoundly nationalistic. Vietnam, Cuba, Palestine. These were all very, very nationalist movements. And the left had no problem celebrating, let's say, Vietnamese nationalism, Vietnamese sovereignty. But the nation state of Israel, of the Jewish people, was the one that was picked out. So I make a distinction between people who are genuinely opposed to the nation state in all forms and people who are opposed to the nation state when it comes to Israel. I've asked people, well, why is Palestinian nationalism good, but Israeli nationalism is bad? Obviously, each of them can take good or bad forms. So I make that distinction. I think that there's a lot of debate now, is criticism of Israel anti-Semitic, which I find a sort of useless question. It's clear that I have a lot of criticisms of Israel, maybe more than some people on, you know, listening to this. My Israeli friends who consider themselves left Zionists are the most critical of Israel. They are far more critical of Israel than I am. So I think it's often a question where a lot of energy is devoted to a question that doesn't really make much sense. Clearly some is and some isn't. I will say that I think that now on the left, and I wrote a piece about this for The Atlantic a couple of years ago, during the last war between Israel and Hamas, that the petitions that I saw being circulated in academia, including by people at my own university, totally freaked me out. They were, in my view, unquestionably anti-Semitic. They were very much about the destruction of Israel, Palestine, from the river to the sea. The hatred, the animus, that the venom towards Israel really, really freaked me out. And the kind of false histories that were, you know, completely, completely inaccurate histories that were being circulated. So there is no doubt in my mind that a lot of the criticism of Israel is profoundly anti-Semitic, but certainly not all of this. But it seems to me a lot of energy is wasted on that. So I've read so many pieces saying, well, it's not necessarily anti-Semitic. Yeah, it's not necessarily anti-Semitic. Mazel tov. Let's move on. But it is often profound, in my view, very, very anti-Semitic. And even now in this latest wave where there have been the terrorist attacks in Israel in the last couple of weeks with people being shot, axed, killed, I see things circulating, quote, on the left, basically celebrating that, or at least saying, well, you know, what can one expect of settler, you know, settler colonialists? So I think the whole debate about whether criticism is or isn't, quote, necessarily anti-Semitic is really a complete waste of time. I think what's important is to look at genuine criticisms of Israel, many of which come from Israelis. I mean, you could read Haaretz every day. And what is really a kind of venom towards Israel that I see not directed, in all honesty, at any other country on earth.
It's the old line about the definition of a British anti-Semite as someone who hates Jews more than is strictly necessary.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me get to the Amnesty report.
Yeah.
Which is really one of now a series of reports. Human Rights Watch has also issued its own denunciations. The whole human rights establishment, with maybe just a handful of honorable exceptions, has become part of the not just anti-Israel industry, but of the anti-Zionist political and ideological movement. And as you point out, this report is very long. It's copiously footnoted. There are areas in which you yourself are in sympathy with some of its objections as it comes to the status of the in the West Bank and Gaza, the occupation. But your indictment of it is really acute and profound. So take us through what is the central flaw in your view of the Amnesty report.
Yes, so first I will say that I have no problem with Amnesty or Human Rights Watch or any other organization issuing reports like this. And I think that, I say in the piece, I read a long piece in the Times of Israel with the writer saying, well, you know, what about Syria and what about the Uyghurs? Well, first off, one of the things about Israel is you actually can go and investigate. You can't investigate what's going on in Syria, you'll be killed. Syria doesn't allow amnesty in. You can't investigate what's going on with the Uyghurs. China doesn't allow amnesty. So yes, Israel is an open society and all sorts of NGOs function there. And I think it's a weak argument. You know, we don't really wanna be in the company of Syria or China. So I have no problem with these reports being issued. And I do agree with some of the prescriptions. I'm against the nation state law. I'm against any more building of settlements. But the central idea of this piece, well, I should say that there are many, many human rights violations that are true that the piece that the report documents. But its subtext, which I say is really its text, is not that Israel is committing human rights violations or the occupation itself is a human rights violation, but that Israel itself is a human rights violation, that the existence of the state is a human rights violation. And as is true of many, many pieces I read in leftist publications, Jacobin, et cetera, it puts forth a very odd history where the founding of the nation and the reasons for the 48 war and the expulsion of the Palestinians, i.e. that Israel was invaded, that the Arab states and the Palestinians didn't accept the partition, is totally evaded, as are the reasons for the 67 war. So what you have is a very kind of odd it's a very odd report because instead of documenting a conflict and what the results of that conflict have been, it essentially suggests that there is no conflict. There are no two sides, that somehow Palestinians were expelled in 48, that somehow this occupation arose in 67 in sort of mysterious, ethereal ways. So it views the founding of the nation and the existence of the nation as a human rights violation. And its main prescription, I would say over and over and over again, is the quote, right of return, that millions of Palestinians and their descendants and their children and their grandchildren should come back to Israel. There's no country in the world that would accept millions of, there's only 10 million people in Israel that would accept, refugees that equal 50 or 60% of its population, many of whom, for good reason in some ways, revile the state, do not accept the existence of the state, would accept a population transfer like that. The whole idea of the right of return, and the more honest advocates of this will admit this, is to turn Israel basically into a majority Arab state. It's the end of sovereignty for the Jewish people. So this is its prescription over and over and over again. So it's a very odd report because although it professes to trace a kind of history, there are no two sides to the history. You simply see Israel as this sort of mysterious and essentially evil aggressor against a presumably simply peaceful and eternally victimized people.
Let me ask you about the use of the term apartheid, because it's such electrified term, yeah. I guess. Talk a little bit about it, because you suggest in your piece that it is justified to use the term apartheid when it comes to the West Bank. It is not justified to use the term apartheid when it comes to the status of Israeli Arabs. I would challenge you on that, but before I open my mouth, I want you to sort of give me a sense of your views.
Yeah, so one of the things I say in the piece is that if you look through Israeli newspapers, a lot of Israeli politicians, and not just from Meretz, you know, very mainstream politicians from Labor, center Labor, have warned of apartheid in Israel, have warned that if the occupation continues, this is apartheid. Friends of mine in Israel use the word apartheid to describe the relationship between Israel and the West Bank and Palestinians in the West Bank. Settlers have one set of laws. Palestinians have another set of laws. It's, you know, denial of rights, denial of the rule of law, etc. So I do think that term, if you want to use that term, is apt. To me, the term, though, is used in a Pavlovian sense. There is, I defy anyone to argue that the use of the term apartheid is not meant to evoke the old South Africa. That is where the term is inevitably linked to. So when the term is used, I think an incorrect equation between Israel and South Africa is being used. The Amnesty report makes no distinction between the status of Israeli Arabs, who, like minorities in this country, do not have equal education, housing, et cetera, but nonetheless are full citizens. And by the way, are voting in higher and higher numbers, are much, much more of a potent political force, which I think is great. In Israel, it makes no distinction between the status of Israeli Arabs who are citizens and the situation in the West Bank and Gaza.
But let me challenge you a little bit about this, because apartheid, even though the word connotes apartness, apartheid was a system devised as a form of racial discrimination and oppression for the sake of racial discrimination and oppression. You didn't have this, apartheid wasn't devised as a response to a genuine security problem, which arises from the frequency with which Palestinians were walking from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, and I am a personal witness to this, and blowing themselves up in buses. The principal opponent of building the separation fence or in parts of the area a wall was actually Ariel Sharon, because for Sharon that meant the division of the land. The apartheidness, as it's, you know, at the allegation here, and what's supposed to be the visible evidence of it, was actually a project of the left, which is separation from the Palestinians, which is then, but there's a difference between a system of racialized segregation on racist principles and a pragmatic need to prevent a segment of the Palestinian population from going and killing Jews. I mean, isn't that a meaningful distinction?
Yeah, it is. And again, you know, in a way, this gets back to you know, the 67 period, the war. So to me, apartheid isn't about the wall, which has, in fact, stopped the suicide bombings. It's about the system in the West Bank. Gaza, I think, is a different, it's hard to know what the hell is going on in Gaza. But the system in the West Bank where, let's say, settlers can kill or attack Palestinian farmers and are never brought to justice, But if a Palestinian attacks a settler, they are brought to a military court. And the occupation, I mean, this to me sort of gets to the tragedy of Israel and my own sense of heartbrokenness. You know, the wall comes after the Second Intifada, but before the Second Intifada, the occupation had been going on for a long time. I don't ever fault Israelis for protecting themselves from terrorism. But I do fault Israelis, as do my friends in Israel, that for decades, the country has not been able to deal with the occupation way before the suicide bombings, that the country has been unable politically to find a solution. Now you could say, well, that's because the Palestinians also refuse solution. Yes, that's also true. I mean, there are so many reasons that Oslo failed. There's so much blame to go around. But nonetheless, the situation is today that a Palestinian living in the West Bank is subject to completely different legal system than Israelis living in the West Bank. And that to me is profoundly unjust. Now, I was just gonna say, I mean, you know, right after 67 and for many years, as we know, before the Second Intifada, you know, there was free movement between the West Bank and Gaza and Israel, and Palestinians would go and shop in Tel Aviv, and Israelis would go and eat fish, you know, on the sea at Gaza. And yeah, I mean, the Second Intifada profoundly changed the situation. I am not an opponent of the separation wall. But what I'm talking about is the lives of Palestinians in the West Bank. I don't think it is defensible. And if you're going to ask me, you know, you said that Sapir is prescriptive, not just descriptive, you know. At this point, I really have no solution. I have no solution. Can Israel just withdraw from the West Bank and be... we know that Hamas, we know that Islamic Jihad is now in the West Bank. I really have no solution to the situation now, but that doesn't mean that I don't think that it deserves condemnation where it deserves condemnation. And yeah, it didn't just come out of nowhere. It came out of somewhere, but nonetheless, and we've had 70 years of this. That's a very, very long time. That's a very long time.
So if I were to offer a critique of your article, and I want to say it's a marvelous, luminous article, and I'm going to say this as an editor, it's such a pleasure to get such a well-written draft from an author. You're a wonderful writer. So I'm just pushing you here just for the sake of entertaining our audience. But you make the point, well, 48, your critique of Amnesty's report is, They act as if 48 sort of was just happened, right, without any context. And they act as if 67 just happened without any context. And I would argue that the missing part of your piece is that the failure of Oslo, right, just sort of happened, right? That it wasn't at all affected by the character of Arafat's regime, the way in which the Palestinian Authority played a double game with Hamas, simultaneously repressing them, but also encouraging them. The role of Hamas and Fatah during the Second Intifada, which traumatized Israelis. I mean, it's not for nothing that you had a majority of Israelis who were prepared to go to Oslo, who were prepared to go to Camp David, who installed Ehud Barak with a huge mandate in 1999, only to see him return with a rejection in 2000. That also has a context, and what you have here is a case not of a failure of Israel to do right, but of an epic divorce that has gone wrong in a manner sort of befitting, what's that film with Michael Douglas, The War of the Roses, on the world's worst divorce. that's really the story here and the nuance that I think the left fails to grapple with. But I'd love to hear your thoughts and response.
My thought and response is that I don't disagree with any of that, but I think that it's also partial.
Okay.
Because remember, Rabin is killed by an Israeli. It may be that the majority of Israelis were supportive of Oslo, but even at that time and before that time, I mean, remember the crowds of settlers in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv screaming for Rabin's death, that he's a traitor, that he's a Nazi, that he's a capo, I mean, the worst. And my critique, you know, I doubt that most Palestinians are supportive, I don't know this for a fact, but are supportive of suicide bombings, but they've been unable to oppose that within their own society. And Israelis have been unable to oppose the building and building and building and building of the settlers. That I don't believe that the settlers represent most Israelis, and yet the society has somehow, it's sort of like here, you know, most people want gun control, but somehow the gun lobby always wins. I think you're painting every critique of the Palestinians, absolutely. And it may be that no matter what Israel had done, the situation would be as it is, or as bad as it is in some other way. But I think that you're underestimating that starting, you know, after the 67 war, the rise of Messianic Zionism, which would have been completely an oxymoron to the early Zionists, the rise of religious Zionism, which basically, you know, it's like Hezbollah, they're the party of God, religious Zionism, you know, you can't argue with the conflation of politics and religion. Religious fanatics put themselves outside of the law. They answer to God, they don't answer to the law. So I think that, and the despair of my friends in Israel has been the inability of normal Israelis who I don't think particularly even support the settlements, like the settlements, all the money that goes to the settlements, et cetera, but somehow this group has been able to exert an enormous, enormous, enormous amount of political power. I mean, Netanyahu could never have been in power for so long if he didn't have the support of those groups and those parties. So everything you're saying is true, but I think that there has been a failure of Israel internally to grapple with its own crises. And you can read many, many, I mean, in my piece, I quote Yossi Alfer, who writes a column every week that I read. He's a former Mossad official. He is saying this. He is saying we're going towards a terrible one-state reality with a Palestinian majority if we don't somehow change course. And I'm not sure how that can happen.
I'm gonna go to questions in just a moment, but one final question from me. You sound terribly pessimistic. Is that fair?
So, you know, I feel that there's a lot going on in the world today, and I feel I have no right to be pessimistic. I mean, I feel Zelensky isn't pessimistic, so what right do I have to be pessimistic? The Ukrainians are, you know, under barrage and they're not pessimistic, so what right do I have as a, you know, safe, secure, relatively safe, secure American to be pessimistic? So I feel in a way that pessimism is a little bit of a luxury, that, and it's a little bit of a sin. And my father always taught me to take the very long view of history, all of which is to say I'm struggling very mightily to not be pessimistic.
Good answer. So now we're gonna turn to our audience. So Someone named H. Fragman Abramson begins by saying, always concerned with the terminology, especially quote unquote occupation when international law does not support the premise. Why is this being used within the context of Zionism? Do you want to answer Mr. Abramson?
I'm a little confused. International law, as far as I know, does in fact use the word occupation for the Israeli control of the West Bank. The idea of Oslo was that the West Bank, and at that time Gaza, this is pre-Hamas taking over, would be the basis of a Palestinian state. And I believe that international law, from everything I've read, does consider the West Bank to be occupied. I mean, again, one of the things that I think Israel hasn't been able to grapple with is that it doesn't exactly have a border. It doesn't annex the West Bank, in which case Palestinians would have to be citizens or there really would be apartheid, but it also doesn't leave the West Bank. And I don't think that you can have a sovereign nation without a border. The whole idea of Zionism was, in fact, to have a sovereign territory. And I think one of the strange and unresolved and very destructive things about the situation now, there's actually a book by an Israeli called A Land Without Borders. So yeah, I don't think the word occupation, apartheid may be controversial, but I don't think that the word occupation is controversial. I'm not sure what else it would be called.
I once made the mistake of driving from Lebanon into Syria without knowing that I had crossed a border, because one of the little known facts about the Lebanese-Syrian conflict, which is now largely forgotten, but lasted for 29 years as an occupation, is that there is no border that Syria recognizes between itself and its Lebanese neighbors. Sam Hillard asks, Michael Oren, in a book on his role as an ambassador, writes that the difference between Bill Clinton and Barack Obama in Israel is the Clinton view was formed in 67 and Obama's view was formed by the 1982 Lebanon War. Can you comment on this?
I have not read that book. I have to say, in all honesty, I have no idea what Barack Obama's views on the Middle East, what formed them. I think the Middle East was the worst moments of his administration had to do with the Middle East. I think that he was completely, completely out of his league. In terms of the Middle East, especially in what I consider his catastrophic and completely immoral inability and refusal to deal with the catastrophe in Syria, with the Syrian civil war. So I feel that Obama was a kind of kumbaya candidate or president in terms of the Middle East and had very, very, very little understanding of the forces in the Middle East. And like many Americans, including a lot of people on the left, but some people on the right too, in a different way, I think tended to assume that the American paradigm, the multicultural democracy that America is, was in some sense, some kind of model for the Middle East. And I think he had very, very, very little understanding of anything going on in the Middle East, including what the results of the Arab Spring would be.
Jeffrey Herf, who I know is a wonderful historian and author of a recent book on the creation of the state of Israel, is on the call. So I'm going to ask his question. He thanks you for having you here. One source of contemporary antagonism to Israel, he says, is a bundle of misconceptions that assert that Israel was a product of so-called, quote unquote, American imperialism in 47, 48. The liberals and left liberals of those years saw the Zionist project as an anti-imperial one, and the Palestine Arab leadership is influenced by its collaboration with the Nazi regime. Would you please talk a bit about your excellent chapter on Eye of Stone in The Lion's Den?
Hello, Jeffrey. Thank you for your new book. We've emailed, we've never met. There's the left has had a complete reversal, absolutely. Most of the left supports Israel in the 47-48 war. Israel is first off, again, you know, there were the kibbutzim, sort of the purest form of socialism. It was very much seen that here was an endangered people who had only recently sort of survived. The remnants had survived the genocide, fighting for independence, fighting for sovereignty. And it was the British who were seen as the imperialists. The US, by the way, as far as I know, Jeffrey, you know more about this, was not particularly germane. The US was not sending arms. Communist Czechoslovakia was sending arms. And the British, of course, were leading the Arab League, were supporting the Arab states. And yeah, I mean, the Arab states were seen as the sort of backward feudal imperialist powers fighting basically what was seen as a socialist democracy. So you have people like I.F. Stone, Robert Capa, Martha Gellhorn. I mean, so many people who were of the anti-fascist left were supporting Israel. As I say, Israel was getting its arms from a communist country. So the idea that Israel was somehow created by the US, or created for that matter by the British don't even vote in favor of partition. This is just really entirely, entirely false. Again, this changes a lot with the 67 war. I have a lot of respect and admiration and affection for I.F. Stone, but I think he was very, very wrong about a couple of things. One, he put forth, and here we see the irony, he put forth Lebanon as a model for Israel, that here was Lebanon, this multi-sectarian, multi-religious country, and that Israel could become that. Well, we've seen what Lebanon has become. He also thought that once Egypt signs the peace treaty with Israel, Israel withdraws from the Sinai, he believed that this would be a model for the Arab world. Unfortunately, the exact opposite happened. Israel is expelled from the Arab League. It is reviled, becomes the pariah of the Arab world. It is seen as a traitor. So one of the things I say, you know, in my chapter, is that I think that he was sort of taking sort of tenets of American democracy and imposing them on the Middle East, where they really proved to be incorrect.
Sylvia Berger, a college professor, says, what are the political forces in Israel that would effectively achieve the goal of dismantling the occupation while preserving the right to exist principle?
So I'm not an Israeli. I read the Israeli press. I try to speak to people in Israel. I think there are Israeli intellectuals who could probably answer that better than I. The left, I mean, Brett alluded to this, and he's right. The left in Israel, the peace camp, if we can even use that term, was decimated by the Second Intifada. And from everything I've read, that was actually purposeful on the part of Hamas and parts of Fatah. They wanted Oslo to fail. They wanted the peace process to fail. Who knows what would have happened if that had not been so, if Rabin had not been killed, et cetera, et cetera. So the left is very weak in Israel. I would say the center is not so weak. I know less about what sort of centrist politicians or just ordinary people, where they are. My understanding is, you know, there's now an interesting coalition government, of course, although it may be in danger of falling apart. My understanding is that the sense in Israel right now is that there is no solution. Bennett has been pretty clear about saying, we're not going to deal with the occupation, which, by the way, is a term that pretty much everyone in Israel uses, including the right, as I understand it. But we can't deal with it. And in elections right now, that is not the main topic at all. Domestic issues, as I understand it, are the topic. So what would change that? I do not know. I really don't know. As we know, terrorism always pushes people to the right. It has pushed Israelis to the right. It pushed Americans to the right after 9/11. Terrorism pushes people to the right. You know, I've heard some people say, well, if there was a big crisis again and the Palestinians rose up, then Israelis would deal with the occupation. No, the opposite would happen. They would, for understandable reasons, move to the right to even harsher measures. So in all honesty, I really don't know. I don't know the answer to that. And from what I, at least what I've read, the younger generation, we often tend to think that younger generations are, quote, more liberal than their parents. I think in a lot of ways in Israel, the opposite is true, that younger people have grown up with the occupation as just sort of a fact of life. They didn't live in the pre-67 Israel. They didn't live in the labor-dominated Israel. So I really have no answer at all to that question, but I'm sure there are people wiser than I who are writing about it.
I would suggest just briefly that one possible venue or avenue is the Abraham Accords, that rather than trying to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict from the inside out, from the center to the periphery, ultimately, it may happen from the outside in, that a broad peace between Israel and all of its neighbors will lead to a peace with Israel and its nearest neighbors, although it's hard to imagine that happening while Iran maintains a sort of whip hand over the forces of Palestinian rejectionism. Let me see here. We have Saul Rosenberg, who says, I would love to push you on some kind of first step toward a solution. If you insist that Israel find a solution or face a one-state solution with a Palestinian majority, aren't you encouraging the Palestinians to resist any Israeli solution? And isn't that what's been going on all these years from the Palestinian leadership, Arafat, Abbas, and Haniyeh?
Well, I don't think it's up to me to encourage the Palestinians. I don't think the Palestinians are listening to Susie Linfield or to anybody else on this call, in all honesty. I don't think it's fair to link Abbas with the head of Hamas. I think that is incorrect. Abbas, I believe, does except two states. The problem is he's completely feckless, powerless, undemocratic, has no support, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think it's really, I don't think that what I say or really what anyone in America says is having too much encouragement or discouragement on the Palestinians. One thing I will say in terms of what Brett just said, that the thing that would probably change the Middle East most, including the Israeli-Palestinian or Israeli-Arab conflict, is, though I don't think this is going to happen, is the overthrow of the Ayatollah in Iran. A democratic Iran would change the Middle East more than anything else that we can possibly think of.
Well, a non-radical Iran. I mean,
yeah.
Iran was not democratic under the Shah.
No. Although there were democratic forces in the original revolution, they were all killed. But in any case, yeah, a different Iran, a democratic Iran, an Iran that was not the force of death and destruction throughout the Middle East and other parts of the world, That would change the Israeli situation more than anything else we can think of.
We're coming to the end of our time, but sort of apropos the last question, Howard Lupovich asks, do you agree with the assertion by Daniel Gordas and others that diaspora Jews should refrain from criticizing Israel? That is, only those who defend the state have a right to criticize it. Conversely, should the same be true of Israelis vis-a-vis diaspora Jewish life? I think I know your answer, but I'd like to hear it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely disagree with that. There's obviously an intimate relationship, although a complicated one, between diaspora Jewry and Israel. Also, we live in a country that gives an enormous, enormous amount of aid to Israel. I have Israeli friends who actually oppose that and feel that America has helped to build the settlements, a key stumbling block. So no, I'm, in general, I'm not an advocate of squashing critique. I think that the more critique, the more free thought, the more argument, the more debate, the better. We live in a time, I think, not just in terms of this topic, but of so many topics where there are so many strictures. You shouldn't talk about this. You shouldn't talk about that. No, I believe in the opposite. Absolutely. Criticize, debate, learn. The more of that, the better. Israel should not become a kind of enclosure that is somehow some sort of sacred space that, quote, can't be critiqued. Absolutely not. That's a kind of exceptionalism that I completely, completely disagree with. Any more than I would say that, you know, other people have no, quote, right to critique America. Of course they do. So I believe in critique. I believe in debate. I will point out that from what I read and from people I know and from the times that I've been there, debate in Israel about Israel is much freer than it is in the US. That things that some people say you shouldn't say that about Israel, Israelis say about Israel. So no, I believe in the more debate, the more critique, the more communication, the better.
It's a wonderful note for us to close on, Susie. And I wish I could, I always feel in all of these conversations, I wish I could get to all of the questions. There were many questions about the use of the term occupation. I feel you addressed it as comprehensively as we could. But you know, the point you're making at the end here, I think, is the most important for us. We believe in argument for the sake of heaven as Jews. And we're trying to believe in argument for the sake of heaven as publishers and editors of Sapir. So I really want to thank you, Susie, for a wonderful hour of candor and real thoughtfulness and great intellectual honesty. And I really want to thank our audience for remaining so engaged in these conversations, which are genuinely important and important to be had respectfully across some ideological lines. It's more interesting to talk to people who have a different point of view than the same one. At least that's my experience. So thank you so much for participating in this call. Thanks, Susie. Thanks to the audience. And we look forward to revisiting these arguments many times in the future. Have a lovely day.